This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Coming up on June 22nd, the Chicago Lighthouse is offering a gala presentation. And at that presentation will be a very special award that is being handed out for a couple from Gary who have been involved in successful business and a lot of other things here in Northwest Indiana. As a result, they in turn have also been dealing with a situation that one might think is just as a handicap, but has turned out to be an advantage, I think, in business in Northwest Indiana. We're talking about Steve Panger, who is a very successful businessman in Gary, his wife, Georgianne, who is successful in her own right, and working along Stephen's side these years. They are going to be honored on June 22nd for their humanitarian efforts on behalf of the Chicago Lighthouse, which, if you are not familiar with the organization, it's a nationally acclaimed social service organization that assists people who are blind or visually impaired or disabled, and veterans as well, too. Everybody is in the same envelope there as far as the Chicago Lighthouse is concerned. We have the Pangers, Steve and Georgianne, with us here in the studio to talk about themselves, the business successes that they and all the problems that owning a business can bring, and to talk about the presentation coming up as well, too. Steve, first, thank you very much for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Chris, thanks for having us.
Well, you're welcome here. And Georgianne, same to you.
Thank you very much.
Steve, we'll not dwell on this, but tell us a little bit about yourself, about the visual problems that you encountered in life, and then let's talk, if we can, about the ways that you've been able to turn what some people may consider a disability into an asset, basically.
Well, Chris, I have an inherited retinal disease called rod cone dystrophy. I didn't realize that I had it until I was around 20 years old, because I used to drive. And as my sight, as I started to have issues with sight, and that's when we also met Dr. Fishman, he brought the fact up that I had rod cone dystrophy, and it is a disease that continues on, and what's the word I want
to use? Degenerative.
It's a degenerative disease. Uh-huh. So as time went on, I made it through college. I did have some sight. I became what you call legally blind. And I will say about 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, what they call blind. Now, I still see light. I still have very little sight. Mm-hmm. But it was degenerative. So you say, how did I get along? Well, I was able to get through college. I was able, in the construction business, not that I could drive, but I could go out to the job sites with the guys. I was able to do a little bit of work. That helped me learn the business. So I would say in the 80s, I could no longer really go out to the job like I used to, but I learned enough to start managing the business I worked with my father and my brothers as well.
Did you find that advantage that you did have while you did have sight in knowing the business ahead of time, as well as being in the family, basically, that has helped you get along to this point today where you continued on and make the business successful and remembering what you did and put all these advantages, put these things together into an advantage, I guess, is like I said, rather than a liability?
It was a major advantage to be able to work, you know, in a little bit in the field and work with my father to learn the business. But he also taught me quite a bit. And I think the main thing he would say is failure is not an option. He never babied us. My father actually, he did raise us because our mother died when we were very young. So failure was not an option. It took a while working with the guys in the field. They knew we had an eyesight problem and that I had a problem with it. They knew it was degenerative. I ended up proving to them that I could manage the business. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't believe that they look at me as blind. In fact, I didn't realize I was really blind. I wouldn't admit it until probably 10 years ago.
When you were at the Seeing Eye, you called me.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I got my dog Hope.
Yes.
When I got my guide dog Hope, I think that's when I admitted that I was blind. I wouldn't admit it before that.
Now, let's shift to today, now that you have your guide dog with you, and Georgianne, of course, has been with you all these years, too. What is an average day like finding yourself basically now legally blind in that respect? How difficult is it, or do you find that there are advantages with the routine that you have now that you can come into the office and do what you need to do, help out with the crews and all, and whatever else that needs to try and make your construction, the family construction company, is as successful as it is?
I would describe it's frustrating. It is frustrating.
Yeah.
However, we are not different. I will say that me as a blind person or other blind people, we are not different. We just learn to do things differently. Mm-hmm. We have good employees. I don't believe that they look at me that way. They understand that I understand the business. I understand it very well. I made sure that I could understand. I understand estimating contracts, working with the guys on whether it's scheduling customers, customer relations, which Georgiana has been very, very helpful with me in that respect. We do it together. So I do have technology that helps me. I have a computer. It's called a screen reader. It reads to me. I can do my emails. I have a scanner that takes pictures of articles, whether or contracts. It will read that back to me. Newspapers or magazines. I have a money reader. I have a color reader. There's all types. I have a talking calculator. So there's not much there.
You have your own GPS too.
And
you know
GPS.
Where you're going.
And I have my guide dog.
Well, you can see the technology has advanced so much since the days of basically Braille, of having to use a Braille typewriter, punching holes in the paper, and having to read things off paper by means of Braille. The technology has made it so much easier for folks that have limited sight or no sight at all, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. Technology is terrific.
Let's go to I guess just a few years ago, when the family got together and created what is known as the Panger Center for Inherited Retinal Diseases, which is set up there at the Chicago Lighthouse.
Jan, why don't you take that?
You know, yes, Steve has known Dr. Fishman for more than 40 years. And when he told us he was going over to the Lighthouse from UIC, mm-hmm. I said, let's go look at the Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. And we were so amazed at what they did there that Steve and I just looked at each other, and we knew we were going to concentrate mm-hmm. on Dr. Fishman's research, and established then the Center for Inherited Retinal Diseases.
Mm-hmm. What does the center do these days now? Obviously working very closely with the entire Chicago Lighthouse operation, but mm-hmm. what specifically does the center do?
Their purpose is threefold. It's education, it's diagnosis, and it's research. Mm-hmm. So you have residents, you have interns from all over the world, actually, coming to work with Dr. Fishman. There are physicians, there are people who go to Dr. Fishman who may have conditions that need another diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And they'll come there as well. And, of course, he is one of the world's known researchers in retinal diseases.
Mm-hmm. Now that the center's set up here, working very closely with the Chicago Lighthouse, the Lighthouse has certainly recognized you for your achievements in the past. What is it that you've learned, if they've told you very much? I know they try to keep things a surprise if they can, but I'm sure they don't want to keep too much of this a surprise. Tell us what is going to happen on June 22nd and how you are all part of that.
I believe since we established the Panger Center back in 2010 and we have supported it since then, they're recognizing us for what our contribution is, you know, for the Lighthouse, as well as Dr. Fishman and his research. He is doing some special research right now, which is in gene therapy, which is very special. It's FDA approved, mm-hmm. and he's working on gene therapy on actually night blindness, which has a lot to do with rod cone dystrophy.
And by the way, the Pangers will be honored. They'll receive the Lighthouse's prestigious Beacon of Light Award at the annual Seeing What's Possible Gala, which is on June 22nd. It'll be at the Four Seasons Hotel on Chicago's Near North Side. Several struggling Indiana school districts could eventually be affected by a controversial school takeover bill that legislators passed during the special session. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports that while the measure specifically addresses the Gary and the Muncie Community Schools, it also lays out some new rules for other school districts that are in financial distress.
You don't have to look very far in Paoli to see the community's pride for its schools. Right in front of the town's offices sits a ram, the high school mascot. But lately, That pride's been overshadowed by constant news about the district's finances. Interim Superintendent Gerald Jackson is frank about the situation.
If things hadn't changed in 19, they couldn't have paid the staff, okay?
Last summer, Casey Brewster, who served as superintendent at the time, resigned. The school board didn't provide many details, except to say Brewster was incompetent in the areas of academic progress and financial management. The district then brought Jackson on to serve in the role temporarily as they searched for a more permanent replacement. He's cut about 10% of the budget in less than a year through a combination of teacher layoffs, buyouts, retirements, and only buying supplies the district absolutely needs.
I have been known all my life to be kind of a tightwad, if you understand what I'm saying.
Jackson says he expects the district's general fund to finally be back in the black in the coming months, but there are still questions about the state of its finances. Paoli is among several school districts mentioned at the State House this week that could be put on a watch list as part of a school takeover bill called House Bill 1315. Like Gary and Muncie, enrollment continues to decline here. Over the past 20 years, the district's lost about 200 students, which is nearly 13% of the student body. And for the past several years, Paoli has received a C on its annual report card from the state.
When you see that C and everybody around you is a B or an A, where are they going? You know, anymore, you can send your child anywhere you want to.
Democrats who spoke against the bill this week warned that school districts like Paoli could be hurt by the bill. Muncie Representative Sue Arrington says she feels legislators representing the communities directly impacted were shut out of the conversation.
I'm concerned that even when we're showing improvement under our emergency manager, it doesn't seem to matter to the people in the General Assembly. And I think that's a bad sign.
The bill includes several changes in the governing of Muncie and Gary schools that strip the elected school boards of any power. Gary Teachers Union President Gleneva Dunham says that essentially takes away the community's input on the future of the school districts.
I'm a resident of Gary, citizen, born and raised there, voter, a taxpayer. So I think it's really unfair. I think it's unjust to strip the vote away.
Under House Bill 1315, a committee will outline factors it will use to analyze the financial condition of school corporations. Districts that appear to be heading toward financial distress could have to come up with a corrective action plan. The state board charged with overseeing those plans will meet behind closed doors when it receives reports on how schools are doing. Republican Representative Mike Karakoff says the measure will prevent more school corporations from ending up like Gary or Muncie.
It's a good bill. We're doing the right thing. $17 million really misused in Gary schools, and we've not been paying our bills, or Gary's not been paying their bills up there. And all of us, students across the state, have been paying those bills.
That's a view that's shared by some outside of the State House. Jackson actually thinks the bill could be good for districts like Paoli. He takes comfort in knowing the state could be providing struggling schools more guidance.
They need to watch what's going on. And I know people talk about Big Brother watching you. You know, I read 1984 when I was a child, okay? But in this business, the school board is in control. They really are. But sometimes things can get out of control pretty quick.
Jackson's hopeful the cuts he's made will be enough to keep Paoli off any bad list. But it's a situation that will soon be out of his control. A new superintendent starts June 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and it's time once again for Greenfleet Radio. And here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, today our guest is Mr. Ken Parent. He's the director for biofuels for the Indiana Corn Marketing Council. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Well, thanks, Carl.
Ken, I know you're involved with a number of different organizations. Tell our listeners what does the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and the Indiana Corn Growers Association, what do you do?
The Indiana Corn Marketing Council delivers relevant research that farmers can put into practice. We grow value and return on investment through marketing and education, and we build demand and broaden markets for Indiana's corn farmers. And all these programs are funded with Indiana corn checkoff dollars.
Mm-hmm.
The Indiana Corn Growers Association represents Indiana corn farmers on industry issues. It advocates at the local, state, and federal levels, and it unites Indiana corn farmers through membership. No checkoff dollars are used to fund these activities.
I see. So I know we're particularly interested in working with you on ethanol. So how are the Indiana corn growers helping the ethanol market?
Well, we focus in several different areas. Number one, we educate consumers in regard to the environmental benefits of ethanol. We also educate fuel retailers regarding the value of adding higher ethanol blended fuels to their lineup. And we provide funding for ethanol infrastructure at the retail level and work with fuel retailers on ethanol education and promotion.
So how can a user of a vehicle, how can they tell if their cars actually can use ethanol?
Well, flex fuel vehicles are compatible with fuels containing up to 85% ethanol, also known as E85. Some FFVs will carry a flex fuel badge on the rear of the vehicle. Most will have a yellow gas cap. The use of E85 reduces greenhouse gas emissions significantly. The EPA has approved fuels containing up to 15% ethanol, also known as E15, and sometimes marketed as regular 88 or unleaded 15, for all vehicles manufactured since 2001. E15 features 88 octane compared to the 87 octane of regular gasoline and is frequently priced at 3 to 5 cents lower than regular gas. E85 is available at more than 200 locations in Indiana. There are a couple of phone apps that provide directions to E85 retail sites. E15 is available at more than 30 locations around the state, and we're seeing rapid expansion of E15 offerings at retailers such as Family Express, Thornton's, Circle A Food Marts, and Casey's.
Absolutely. We're speaking to Mr. Ken Parent, Director of Biofuels for the Indiana Corn Marketing Council. So I know that you're talking about just all the great things that ethanol provides, but can ethanol help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutants?
Well, studies have shown that ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 43% mm-hmm. when compared to petroleum-based fuels. In fact, a recent study from the USDA found that ethanol reduces greenhouse gases by as much as 50% when compared to petroleum. It also reduces toxic aromatic emissions such as toluene and benzene. Those are fuel components that are known carcinogens. And we reduce fine particle emissions that are harmful, particularly in people suffering from asthma and in children.
I know South Shore Clean Cities had partnered with the Indiana Corn Marketing Council to help expand ethanol pumps in our state. Can you talk a little bit about the Hoosier Homegrown Fuels Grant and what it's accomplished?
Sure. Hoosier Homegrown, it's tough to say.
It is tough
Hoosier
to say.
Hoosier Homegrown Fuels Program was initiated in 2015 mm-hmm. with a grant from the United States Department of Agriculture, and it featured investments from the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and fuel retailers such as Family Express, Lassus Brothers, and Thornton's. The program also received support from South Shore Clean Cities, Greater Indiana Clean Cities, and the Indiana State Department of Agriculture. The funds were used to provide funding for flex fuel dispensers for E15 and E85 at approximately 30 locations around Indiana. The last of those projects should be completed by the end of this year.
Wonderful. So how can people learn more about the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and your work with ethanol?
Well, in addition to the Indiana Corn website, which is indianacorn.org, there's also a number of industry websites that provide ethanol information. These include getbiofuels.com, the American Lung website, which is cleanairchoice.org, and one from the Renewable Fuels Association, which is ethanolrfa.org. All of these provide a lot of information about biofuels and ethanol in particular.
You know, I know you just recently held your event on May 17th. Could you tell our listeners how that went?
The Ethanol Forum, Indiana Ethanol Forum, is really designed to reach out to our key stakeholders, particularly those in government at the state level and also congressional level, to update them on issues of surrounding ethanol. There is always a lot going on. particularly in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we try to keep them updated. Ethanol has seen tremendous growth here in the state. We have 14 ethanol plants producing about 1.25 billion gallons of ethanol each year, all going into motor fuels around the country.
I see. Doing some great work, Ken. Any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our program?
Well, you know, we're looking at that next generation engine that's going to be even cleaner burning than the ones on the road now. The automakers are focused on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and meeting the CAFE standards that are currently in place. And to do that, they feel that they need to use a higher octane, lower carbon fuel. And an ethanol fuel containing about 25% ethanol would be ideal in helping them to achieve that objective.
Well, Ken Behrens, always a pleasure to have you on the Green Fleet Radio. And thanks again for being on the show today. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Ken.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And if you happen to miss it, you can catch the podcast of Green Fleet Radio on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Also on our NPR One app, just search for WLPR. Lakeshore Public Radio's newest furry friend, Ollie, is joining us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions in our newest segment called Ask Ollie, which is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I heard about your advice column from my human grandmother who resides in Ogden Dunes and calls me her granddog. I have an unusual problem with my human parents. They get angry at me for what I do at night, which is crawl into their bed. You see, I'm just a French bulldog, 2-month-old puppy, so I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. I love to sleep between them because it's so warm and comfy there. I'm quite small, so I don't take up much room, and I'm very quiet, so I don't wake them. But they just keep putting me on the floor, saying, Walter, this bed is not for dogs. Don't you just love the name they gave me? I feel so rejected, I want to cry. But I'm single-minded, and I don't give up. Unfortunately, neither do they. So, Ollie, please help me convince them that I really need their bed and that I will sleep in my own bed when I get older.
Dear Walter, uh-oh, once in the bed, always in the bed, and I should know, and I'm an older dog, I'm still there. In the ideal world where a dog is perfectly trained, trainers recommend that no dog should ever be allowed on beds or on furniture. Young dogs should sleep in a crate or in their own bed, not in bed with their human master. The human's bed is the highest, most special place in the house and should be reserved for humans only. Nice try. Dogs see this issue quite differently. They see the bed as a den, sanctuary, or retreat. A dog feels safe with his or her humans, and the humans, no doubt, feel a little protected. I have always slept with my human parents, and so do the other 4 dogs that live in our house. Well, we are small, bathed, we are flealess, not to be confused with fearless, and it's great they have a king-size bed. We are all housebroken and know our special spot on the bed. We sleep only there. We are all older and sleep through the night, with the exception of 1 Opie Taylor who occasionally jumps off the bed in pursuit of a squeaky toy. So there it is. I have heard humans say that the rhythm of dog breathing while sleeping can be very comforting to the human bedfellows. There's one downside to dogs for them sleeping in beds with humans. My man-human never moves once he falls asleep. He snores, but that's okay, because I snore too. My woman-human is a very restless sleeper, which she says is because she has attention deficit disorder. Well, we know it as ADD. That means she flails her legs around and turns over 100 times a night. Maybe not that many, but it seems like it. So several of us who sleep at the bottom of the bed on her side have found ourselves kicked out of bed and on the floor. Ouch! My human parents have a friend named Sharon who raises dogs for show. She has 5 dogs. When asked where her dogs slept, she said that 3 were in the bed, 2, she said, were in crates, which is the proper place for them to be. When asked where the crates were located in the bedroom, she said, "We have made them into end tables at both sides of the bed. Go figure." I'm interested in hearing about who wins the Battle of the Bed. You, a comical little guy with bat-like ears and a pug nose, are really just too cute to either be put down or turned down. I believe your humans have already lost the Battle of the Bed. Am I right? Your friend in fur, Ollie.
If you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email it to Ollie at Lakeshore Public Media, all one big long word, .org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana, and Ollie's responses are voiced by his human, Victoria Voller. And by the way, the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana is hosting an Adopt-a-thon on Saturday, May 26th, and it'll be at Pawn King at 6924 Broadway in Merrillville. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We're coming up to a rather sad anniversary very soon. Back in June 22nd of 1918 was a very specially noted disaster that happened here in Northwest Indiana. One person is calling it the day that the circus didn't come to town. We're talking about what is going to be the 100th anniversary of the Hagenbeck-Wallace train wreck that happened actually in Hammond, or Ivanhoe actually is the real name for the community where it happened at the time. And with us to talk about what had happened, because he wrote a big long story for the Times of Northwest Indiana when he was working for the Times, Phil Potempa is with us here in the studio. Phil, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, this is a very, very sad situation here, and people have no doubt have forgotten about it. They did have a remembrance ceremony at the cemetery over in Forest Park, Illinois, where they call the Showman's Rest. That's a place over there that you can tell us about in particular, what that is over there at the cemetery. But they had a remembrance ceremony about this very sad incident that happened back in 1918. I guess a couple weekends, or about a weekend ago, I guess, is when they had the ceremony. But first, tell us a little bit about the nice things first, the fun things first about the circus, and why it turns out they have this black spot on their reputation.
Exactly. For your listeners that maybe aren't that familiar, you know, these are questions that I'll get for my columns that appear in the Post Tribune, or in this case, you're talking about a spread that ran in the Times newspaper in 2014. There are the incidents that sometimes are that the claim to fame that aren't some of the proudest moments, but they certainly are a part of the timeline in the history of Northwest Indiana. This great circus train wreck, as it's referred to, of 1918, it may not be familiar to a lot of folks. I know it wasn't familiar to me until I wrote about this piece after a book had been published by Richard Lytle, who's one of the fantastic archivists and librarians at the Hammond Public Library. And if you think about circuses and the original culture at the turn of the century, there wasn't, of course, television. I mean, there was radio if you had access to it. But the circus and live entertainment in vaudeville was what people would think to kind of forget your cares and be entertained. And circuses, of course, traveled from town to town, and they did it by train. The classic images of the circus train, of course, being in most people's minds. Well, unfortunately, on this fateful night in June, what happened in 1918 was one of the trains was traveling its way through to meet its next travel destination, and as it was making its way through the stretch that would be Hammond, you know, area proper, another train where the engineer had dozed off collided and created this terrible catastrophe and such a great loss of life that filled newspaper headlines around the country for days following the tragedy.
Now, for people that aren't familiar with what a circus train is, describe, if you will, what the train is and why it is so important to be able to get that circus to go from one town to another and make the circuit that they always have.
Exactly. If you think of what goes into the showmanship of a circus, there's the tents, there's the animals, there's the talent and all the crew. And primarily, they live on the train as it travels across the country. I mean, it was a very affordable way for travel. People were not flying, of course, back then, and it would not have been economical to transport so many needed supplies for these circuses. So they would go by rail. And when you look at this and you think about, okay, and I should state here, this was not the Ringling Brothers or Barnum and Bailey Circus that so many people are familiar with. It was another show that was owned by other businessmen and investors. And so usually there would be two trains. So the biggest misconception, people think, oh, the great circus train, you know, tragedy and accident. They think of exotic animals running loose through the streets of Hammond. It should be clarified that despite any sensational, maybe magazine covers at the time that were trying to depict what happened, the animals had already been sent ahead on a separate train.
Right.
So they were already reached their next city destination because they had to be fed and cared for. This train, tragically, was carrying all of the human life, the families of the entertainers and the talent. this is where this great loss of life comes in, with so many people who lost their life at that time.
Now, back then, Ivanhoe, or that part of Hammond where this happened, was very remote. It was, I guess, not many people even lived around there. And I guess I'm sure that for a while it took a long time for people to realize that something had happened back there, if it hadn't been for all the publicity about it.
Exactly. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, so it was the very wee hours of dawn. And there was not, fortunately, a lot of residents in that particular stretch of the rail track. The loss of life came from the more than 200 circus performers that were injured and 86 lives that were lost. And you talked about the cemetery observance. That's over at Chicago's Woodlawn Cemetery, where there's a mass grave section that's called the Showman's Rest section, where all of these bodies then were laid to rest with their final services. So, again, it wasn't so much the residents of Hammond, but it was the folks that were on this train. And primarily, so many of them died from the fuel and burns and injuries that sustained from the fires of each of the traveling, you know, housing and sleeping cars.
I imagine that back then, all of the cars were certainly made, they were all made of wood, and they probably weren't very strongly built at that, too, I would imagine. So I can see that's just kindling, that once it catches fire, it creates an awful lot of heat, as well as all the problems that they can be by these people being trapped in these rail cars.
And, you know, author Little, who wrote the book that I referred to in this cover spread that ran in 2014, it's 109 pages. It's a paperback, and it's called The Great Circus Train Wreck of 1918, Tragedy on the Indiana Lakeshore. Mm-hmm. But what is really such a treasure in there, and, of course, very graphic, but are the captions. Photos. You think of 1918, it wouldn't be a lot of opportunity for photographs always being, it's not like everybody had a cell phone to snap things at the scene, but there are some fantastic photographs that show the devastation. And as you mentioned, these cars were made of wood, and they're shattered from this terrible, you know, head-on train collision.
And we had a chance to look at Richard Lytle's book. Was there anything in particular that struck you as something that was certainly more than just a historic explanation of the event itself and things that maybe have happened before and after?
Well, one of the things that I know was so difficult at the time was they were of the belief that when they were going through the victims and doing the identities, they felt that so many of them might have been black men who, you know, are families of diversity that had perhaps were part of the crew, or maybe they were porters that worked on the train at the time, which was not uncommon. But later, as it turned out, so many of the folks, it was really all Caucasians that were injured, but they had been burned so tragically, mm-hmm. beyond recognition, that that's how hard it was to distinguish exactly who was involved in this. Yeah.
Did Mr. Lytle, when he was working on his book, from what you could tell in there, that he had a chance to visit Peru, which I understand here in Indiana, it was there used to be the winter headquarters for the Hagenbeck Wallace Circus, which is the one we're talking about here.
Exactly. That is an area. Matter of fact, a few years back, I covered what was a huge clown festival, and they did a salute to the one and only Red Skelton, who, of course, had his alter ego of his clown, of Freddie the Freeloader, was his other signature character he would play. And that area still plays homage to, and they have a museum there, to the circuses that, again, would winter. And when we say winter, of course, you weren't performing outside in tents. There wasn't all the climate-controlled tents that we have today for Cirque du Soleil and other performance venues as they travel. So they would take the winters off, and, of course, they weren't just sitting around. They were perfecting their acts and fine-tuning for the next season, and Peru was very popular at that time.
That's why I understand that, and I've been to the museum there in Peru. It's been a number of years ago, but that was one of the things that they liked to highlight, was the fact that this was the opportunity that the performers and the people that run the circus in general would use this chance during the winter months to be able to work on acts, to perfect what they'd like to do, something new, so that when they go back out on another tour, that they have something new to show people. Although I'm sure some people, like as I understand it was back in vaudeville days, that, you know, you could just about do the same act almost all your entire career because you never were in the same place. If not once, maybe it took years before you came back around on the circuit to someplace. So people would have forgotten your act. But the idea is that a circus, people wanted to have something new to make it more exciting, more entertaining for the audience.
Exactly. And, of course, there wasn't any fear that somebody was going to see what you're doing on YouTube and then suddenly not be entertained because, of course, we didn't have, again, any of those venues. There wasn't any television. So, therefore, really everything seemed fresh as it went from town to town because – many folks had not ever seen such entertainment. And again, just the exotic animals that would be on display was something to behold, because other than picture books, how would you know what a giraffe looked like or an elephant? But to see that in person was really larger than life.
We're talking to Phil Potempa, who works really with the theater at the Center for Performing Visual and Performing Arts in Munster. But he has been a newspaper reporter and writer for many, many years for the newspapers here in Northwest Indiana. And we're talking about one article in particular that he wrote up back in 2014 when he was working for the Times to explain what had happened, which is now the 100th anniversary of this very great circus train wreck. When you were going through the information in the book and talking to people and checking things out, do you recall anything in particular that struck you about your visit to Peru and the old hometown for many of these trains?
Well, and not even just Peru, but my parents and myself had spent one winter in December going down to around Sarasota area and Tampa in Florida, which is where Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey would winter. Right along there is very famous where they spend those months. And we went to see exactly as they were preparing their next show. And, of course, that show does not exist anymore. Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey have ceased operations as of last year, which is amazing after the centuries that they had performed the traditions. And it really is such a close-knit family. Those performers spend so many hours together in the spotlight and off the spotlight, living together. So if you think of this tragedy that separated families, it wasn't just each person's family, but I'm sure it was the acquaintances of everybody that they worked and ate their meals with. So again, it was a mass devastation.
Once again, we're talking about the 100th anniversary of the great circus train wreck and fire, the devastating fire that happened on June 22nd, 1918. So we're coming up here very soon on the 100th anniversary of this very tragic event that happened in the countryside just outside of Hammond. In Ivanhoe, actually, was the suburb, if you want to call it that, there outside Hammond, where the train wreck actually occurred. And the victims of the train wreck are now in what's called Showman's Rest, which is located at the Woodlawn Cemetery in Forest Park, Illinois. And talking about this, because he wrote an article about this for the Times a few years ago, is Phil Potempa. Phil, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about this. We appreciate it. And we'll, I guess, be looking forward to other stories. And we'll be able to talk with you about some history here in Northwest Indiana and your tap your memory about these things, too.
Thank you. And it's always a pleasure to visit with your listeners. And readers, of course, can always find my columns in the Post Tribune and ChicagoTribune.com.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
I'm Dee Dotson for Lakeshore Update. Need to catch up this weekend on the news you missed from around the region and the Hoosier States? Visit lakeshorepublicradio.org for Lakeshore Update or stream it on NPR One as I fill you in on the week that was. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.
Docents of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation are back on the South Shore train ride to educate and train anybody or entertain anybody that would like to know more as they're riding the train. Robert Taborn is the executive director of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, and he spent some time talking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson not long ago about what people are learning when they're on a hosted train ride.
So tell me about the organization and what your purpose is.
Yeah, the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation's Rail Rangers program. We've been around for about 3 years, and we provide onboard educational programs. We do this several times a year on private historic rail excursions, but our main focus in the last year has been working with the wonderful folks over at the South Shore and Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District to educate passengers about what they see outside their window between Chicago's Millennium Station and South Bend, the Northwest Indiana, Gary, and Michigan City, Miller, and all the communities in between. We tell people what they see outside their windows. They're passing through the state park and the National Lakeshore. We tell a lot of interesting stories about the people, places, history, everything you see outside the window. You know, we have a saying that no one would watch the Travel Channel or maybe the History Channel with the audio turned down. You wouldn't want to listen to it on mute. Imagine all the things you'd be missing. Well, we're kind of the audio that goes along with your train rides. You actually know what you're seeing outside your window.
Yeah, you might want to watch it for the beautiful scenery going by, but without the audio, it would certainly be a lot less richer and a lot less content-filled and, a lot less fulfilling. So why is it important that people know what they're seeing out the window?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons why it's important. First, it's a, you know, 2-2.5 hour ride between Chicago and South Bend. And, you know, we want to get people, first of all, unburied from their laptops or their tablets or their e-reader or movie player and kind of appreciate the landscape. The South Shore line is actually very unique, and I bet a lot of people in Northwest Indiana don't realize that. In the short 90-mile stretch between Chicago and South Bend, you pass near or through 4 units of the National Park Service: the I&M Canal in Illinois, Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore over there in Indiana. You go near the Kankakee River Water Trail, and in the south side of Chicago, you go through right by Pullman National Monument. There's a lot of not only beautiful landscapes, but a lot of history that people don't realize they're traveling near. And when you see and understand the people, places, things outside your window, you're more likely to understand each other and maybe appreciate that beauty, maybe enjoy the state or national parks of Northwest Indiana a little bit more.
Did you say that you pass through these national parks like the I&M Canal on the South Shore?
You do. Three out of the four, you actually will pass through. The I&M Canal, it starts from Millennium Station all the way to 47th Street on the south side of Chicago. It's a National Heritage Corridor since the 1980s. Pullman was just declared a national monument in February 2015 by former President Barack Obama, and they're in the process of preserving some of the homes, the historic hotel where they built the trains, and you literally go a half a block from there. You see it right outside your window on the South Shore. Of course, you go through 15 miles of the Indiana Dunes, and over in St. Joseph County, you go very close to the Kankakee River, a brand new national water trail, which was declared in 2016.
So tell me about the upcoming activities planned by the APRHF.
Yeah, we're really excited. We had a 6-month test partnership on the South Shore. We're a brand new program to see on Saturdays and Sundays, 2 to 3 times a month. We have our volunteers on, and passengers can ride and listen to our programs for no more than their regular train fare. We all volunteer to do these programs, and we don't make any money or anything from that. And passengers don't pay any more than their standard train fare to come and listen to us. So we narrate the route. We don't talk nonstop. We point out landmarks as we go along the route. And that's our main duty. We do one round trip out of Chicago at 8 in the morning. We get to South Bend a little after noon, a little downtime, turn around, and then do a program for our wonderful westbound passengers. And we do this in one car. And again, people can feel free to join us and learn a little bit about their communities in Northwest Indiana.
And what do the interpretive guides do, and how are they qualified and educated about what's out the window?
We've done about 4 to 6 months of research before we began our programs on the South Shore in August, this past August, and all of our guides have attended programs at the National Lakeshore. We've got information from some of the park rangers over at the National Lakeshore, and we've developed actually 120-page book about all the things you see along the route between Chicago and South Bend. Our docents have driven the route. They've taken the train. They've researched the book that we've put together. And, of course, they have some of their own stories. We're always finding new stories. So there's a pretty rigorous training program to be one of our current 12 docents. We have a couple more going through training. So, yeah, we do require a pretty extensive training program before our guides are signed off. We're always learning new sites. And one of my favorite things is, you know, we're learning new sites from some of our passengers. We've had a passenger on a trip a couple weeks ago point out a historic brewery across from Pullman National Monument. And there's a very interesting horse motif that was built into this bar. And we did some research and we found out that it was actually a Schlitz brewery from the 1890s. And doing further research, we found out that Pullman was actually a dry community. So there were tons of bars on the outskirts of the Pullman community on the south side of Chicago, but none in Pullman. So all the workers would go out to these bars, lining the tracks on the other side of the tracks, as you would say, the other side of the tracks, to go drink. And so our passengers are always pointing out questions of what's this, what's that? And if we don't know the answer, you know, it's still a learning process for us. And we enjoy that, learning new routes to point out to future passengers. We enjoy learning about new sites. Like, passenger might ask, well, what is that site? And if it's not something that we've already researched, we will go out and research that. And then if it's interesting, we'll incorporate it into the future program.
So it doesn't cost any more for a train fare to have one of your docents speak to the passengers.
Exactly. It's included in the regular train fare. So all they have to do is buy a regular ticket, check out our website for the 2 to 3 times that we're on the train per month, and then just come and car is marked with some yellow signs. You just come and sit down in the car. Seating is on a first-come, first-served basis, and it does get pretty crowded. But yeah, we all volunteer our time, and so if we don't charge anything, and just you pay your train, regular train fare that you would to ride, and you get to participate. It's a fun, pretty economical, family-friendly thing to do for the spring and summer here coming up.
When do you guys go out on the train?
We do one round trip from Chicago, because most of us are Chicago-based. We leave Chicago at 8:40 in the morning, and there's about 20 stops that people can either hop on or hop off between the Chicago's Millennium Station and South Bend. So you don't have to ride the entire route. If you do, we get to South Bend a little after noon Eastern time. We have a little layover. We then do a westbound program that leaves South Bend at 1:05 Eastern time and gets to Chicago at 2:39 Central time. So people can hop on or off. We'll have some people who just get on in Chicago and we'll ride to Dude Park and then spend a couple hours and catch us on the way back. So there's a lot of opportunities in different stations that people can hop on and off and listen to part of our program, the whole thing, whatever they want to do.
Why do you have this organization?
Yeah, we started the organization about 10 years ago to educate people about the role that passenger train travel has played in American history. A lot of people these days don't appreciate the role that the Transcontinental Railroad might have played or steam engines. Now that we have cars and planes and can get somewhere quickly. And some of that history we felt was dying off. So the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, which is actually headquartered in Northeast Missouri, started with a train lookout point and an exhibition of Amtrak history, a small museum, and some train cars out in Missouri. And it was a great regional thing, but we expanded out in 2015 doing these educational programs on private rail excursions, and then eventually it transitioned also into the South Shore last year. We just feel it's important to educate people about rail history, but also the beautiful parks and trails and all the wonderful things in Northwest Indiana. Maybe they didn't realize was in their neighborhood or not too far away from them.
Do you guys have any exhibit where you could see the highlights of the features that you're talking about?
Yeah, we travel, our interpretive guides will often travel with what we call a mobile visitor center. So we have some props of some of the things that you're able to see along the way. For example, we have a little bit of dune sand, and we have glass jars, because a lot of people don't realize that a big chunk of the dunes was kind of scooped up and moved away. Some of that land of the beautiful 200-foot high sand dunes was moved as landfill for Chicago, and even Northwestern University up in Evanston was built on Indiana dune soil. And a lot of that land was also used to make ball jars, glass jars. So we carry some of the props to show people that, hey, the sand from Northwest Indiana, there's some of those sand dunes that you don't see, were actually these jars. Sometimes we carry pieces of sand that were hit by lightning, and we have pictures of some of the plants that you see along the way. One of the stories that people love is we talk about jellyfish that inhabit this little lake called Sogmi Lake it's up near Hudson Lake, and we carry pictures of what these little jellyfish are, no bigger than a dime or a quarter. They float and come up to the surface in August. So we carry a lot of visuals to enhance these passengers' trips on the South Shore.
Do you have the upcoming dates that you guys are going to be on the trains?
I do. Our dates are 2 to 3 times a month, and they are up on our website right now. If you go to southshoreline.org or dunestrain.com, we have all our dates, and then we have dates, probably a scattering of almost a dozen dates posted all the way to the end of the summer if you want to go check that out. But it's 2 to 3 times a month, Saturdays or Sundays, all summer long, and really it'll be all year round.
What is the largest crowd you guys have ever spoken to?
Oh, we've had a couple, pretty much the whole car full, which is over just under 100 people. We've had this year alone, we have 4 private groups who've requested us to do programs for them. 2 of the groups are with the Dune Lund Seniors out of Chesterton. And then we have a school group who just contacted me a couple days ago from New Carlisle, just into St. Joseph County in Northwest Indiana, who's interested in riding with us. So we'll do programs for school groups, senior groups, as they contact us. We'll have that car jam filled of up to 100, almost 100 people if we can.
Is there anything else you wanted to tell me about this that maybe I haven't asked you about?
No, we just the South Shore never ran anything like this before. So, you know, when they started, they were kind of uncertain how passengers would take in, and they did a 6-month trial. And, the cool thing was they got such positive feedback from the passengers that we signed a whole year contract into 2019 to keep doing this. So, you know, people appreciate it. We just appreciate a round of applause and support, and we appreciate the South Shore taking the risk, taking the chance to have us on. They think outside the box. And the only other thing is, the only thing that really raises money for our groups is, since we don't charge anything, the 120-page route guidebook that our volunteers use, we decided to sell that and make it available for the public. So if you are traveling on a train that we're not on, maybe you do ride on a Monday through Friday, maybe you are a commuter, but you're still interested in listening, we decided, after several people requested it, we decided to sell our books online with all the money we take in going toward to support our program and our handouts and our speakers and some of our travel costs. And the book is Outside the Rails, a rail route guide from Chicago to South Bend. And we have those for sale at our website, Midwest Rails, all one word, MidwestRails.com. And so we sell our book there. And that's really what helps fund the group and even pays for some of our insurance that we have to be on the train. The sales of our book, you know, really helps be able to do the programs. And so we sell the books for $20 on our website. And it's 120 pages, all about the history of the South Shoreline Railroad. And it tells you what you see outside your window. So if you don't have a guide on your train, you can still learn about everything outside your window, no matter what, if you have the book.
Does the book have pictures?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Pictures, maps, everything in it.
Who wrote the book?
Oh, myself, Robert, and my wife, Candace. We have 11 other Amtrak route guide books, too, as well, that we've written over the last 6 years that we sell.
That is Robert Taborn, who is the executive director of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. And tomorrow, of course, being Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll have Giles Bruce and Andrew Steele from The Times, Greg Tejeda from the Post-Tribune, and Brad Miller with Indiana Landmarks will join us as well.